Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am now joined by one of my friends to talk about his Dallas Cowboys. We're doing some stuff this fall with the NFL season and college football season kicking off, some rapid reactions, some stuff that happened. So you're going to be hearing this early on a Friday on your commute last night, but it happened tonight. The Dallas Cowboys go down in heart-wrenching fashion, the Dan Quinn special against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Tom Brady, of course, orchestrating a last-minute drive to give Ryan Succop the opportunity to put the nail in the coffin for the Dallas Cowboys to start 0-1 this season. Bogle, your first reaction to the Dallas Cowboys going down here?
I think they played a really good game. I definitely think that coming off the two surgeries this past off season, not really having a training camp because of shoulder injury, stuff like that. I mean, I think that he was phenomenal and he showed that he's back 100%. And Amari Cooper too, who's coming off there were several players actually coming off surgeries from the off season, but Amari Cooper looked great. He led the team in receptions, yards, stuff like that. Greg Zuerlein definitely struggled in the beginning, missing two or three kicks. But, I mean, he kind of came in whenever it counted and hit that last kick at the end. I think they just gave Tom Brady a little bit they gave him a little bit too much time. Because, I mean, he's, pretty well known for being able to – for game-winning drives. But overall, I think they played well. I'm excited for the season, and I'm excited what's to come.
It's also good that you didn't hear Connor McGovern's name called a whole lot in this game, right? Like, the fact that he wasn't really not having Zach Martin was a problem, but that's not where Vita Vea was lining up all night. That was, I believe, Sue was lining up on that side. Vita Vea is going to give Dak nightmares for weeks to come. Like, what he was doing in this game was illegal in 7 states. But there's nothing really you can do. Not a lot of linemen can match up with Vita Vea right now. But what's interesting with this group, and something I had jotted down in this game, was the Cowboys with a healthy Dak, it is a top 5 NFL offense. Like, this group with a healthy offensive line, even without Zach Martin, this offensive unit's top 5. Like, they're going to finish in the top 5 in offensive DVOA. The defense, still a lot of question marks, that kind of thing. But I don't know. I think there is a lot to like, and people just like discount Dak way, way, way too much, because Dak in Dallas averaged a league high 6.4 yards per play in 2019. They were on their way in 2020 before he got injured, averaging 6.5 yards per play per PFF, and then it fell to 4.7 after he got hurt last year, and obviously the season unloaded. I think what we're on pace for is another 6.5 yards per play. Like, the yak machine, CeeDee Lamb, you had Amari Cooper targeting this Tampa Bay secondary early and often. You had Michael Gallup doing a bunch of stuff underneath, doing a bunch of screens, doing a bunch of pick plays, like all that kind of stuff until he went out. But like, I really like what Dallas is doing. Their offense makes sense. Kellen Moore, I thought, called an elite game. Dak had some floaters in the first quarter, but I think he got more comfortable as the game went on. And he did everything possible to give this team a chance to win. And that Zuerlein missed field goal, that missed extra point. And there were some bad moments. But also, like, you know, Tampa Bay had back-to-back series where, like, Godwin missed a potential touchdown drive where he over the shoulder on third down, and then obviously fumbling into the end zone that Jordan Lewis returned. What happens if Jordan Lewis returns that field goal at the end of the first half?
If Greg Zuerlein makes both of those kicks.
Yeah, it's a lot of what ifs.
It is, and I honestly think that the biggest thing to take away from this game is how much Dallas's offense has, or how much their defense has improved this offseason. Whether just the adding Parsons or the unpopular opinion, if, you know, throwing Dan Quinn in the mix and bringing a fresh set of eyes to this defense could be the turning point of it. Because, you know, Dallas, I feel like for a long time has had, you know, they have a star studded Jerry Jones wants to pack the offense with, you know, the most stars that he can, and defense has kind of lacked in that department. So I think that if Dallas can keep up with, you know, what the defense has showed tonight, you know, they really can make a run at it this year, because I think Tampa Bay is definitely in the team to beat. You know, they brought back all the players from last year. I mean, Tom Brady definitely showed tonight that he's, you know, better than ever. So I think they're the team to beat, and for Dallas to fall, you know, for Dallas to almost beat them shows a lot. And for their defense to be able to shut that down for the moment, well, not so much shut it down, but I mean, to be able to keep the game close, showed a lot as well.
It's a great schedule too. Like, I think you got to be feeling good. We actually play all again in Dallas in November, so I'm looking forward to the Dan Quinn Turkey Bowl on the 14th. But no, you go to LA after this next week, then you got, and it's a 10-day layoff, which is going to be nice after this kind of brutal game. Then you get the Eagles at home, the Panthers at home, the Giants at home, at Pats, at Vikings, Denver at home, Atlanta at home, Vegas at home, at Kansas City. But like, there's a real easy path to seeing, when I look at this schedule, I'm like, the Dallas is, they're going to be fine. Like, this game was one of those games where it doesn't necessarily matter that you didn't come out with a victory because of what you did, what you showed toe to toe. This is a playoff game. It could have gone either way. Like, Dallas showed that they belong in that top echelon group if they're healthy. Like, everything comes down to health in this league, and the Cowboys clearly have the offensive pieces. And like you said, they added some defensive guys like Micah Parsons, going to be a good player. Jordan Lewis looks better. A lot of ex-Falcons in this game. Keanu Neal. It's wild to see that many dudes out there. And I think it was DeMonte Kessie who was out there. But I don't know. I think it's interesting that Jalen Smith's not a thing anymore, and Leighton Vander Esch are just gone from this Dallas defense, and Sean Lee, and it's just new faces. Randy Gregory had a big fumble recovery. Was there a standout for you defensively? Like, was there one guy you were like, wow, that was a lot better? Is it Diggs and that crazy almost pick that he had? He's saving the Mike Evans big play and that 2-minute drill from Tampa. Like, who stood out to you most in the defense?
I definitely think Diggs stood out. I also think that DeMarcus Lawrence kind of had a little bit of a slump last year. And I really think that he showed up this game. And, you know, I hope that is going to be a constant and not kind of, you know, and every now and again kind of thing. And I really think Parsons, you know, is going to be something special. I think that he definitely has the potential to be, you know, the defensive rookie of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's definitely possible. Can you double check with me? Did Ezekiel Elliott play in this game?
He did for a yeah, he did. But I mean,
he was in there.
You know, Tampa Bay also has a phenomenal run defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that showed a lot of Kellen Moore's kind of wit, not to try and just, because, you know, a lot of the talk this offseason has been, oh, Zeke has lost all this weight. He looks blah, blah, blah. He looks great. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. And I mean, instead of, you know, just coming out trying to prove that, they kind of use him whenever they needed him. Realized that, hey, we're not going to be able to run the ball a lot this game, and, you know, went to the air and showed off the, you know, elite receiving core that Dallas has.
Well, speaking of the elite receiving core, who impressed you the most of the big three? Was it Gallup early on before he left the game due to the ankle stuff? Was it Amari Cooper, who also got hurt in a touchdown catch? That man you just had to hold your breath for all the time. And then CeeDee Lamb, who just missed your yak machine and was doing all kinds of stuff in this game, but the drop's still a thing, and it looks like it's going to continue to be a thing for a while. But what do you make of the big three, and who impressed you the most?
I honestly think Amari Cooper impressed me the most in this game, just because I feel like in, you know, especially last year, he's either, you know, kind of iffy, or he was just kind of cold. I don't think that he was really a standout. But I think he came out this game, he made a lot of, you know, big plays, and he really showed himself. But I also think that CeeDee Lamb is going to, something special is going to come of him. As long as, you know, we can keep the offense helping and stuff like that, I think that he's developing. I think if we can get the drops under control, you know, he could be the top receiver on the team.
Would you feel any differently about the Cowboys right now if they had won this game?
I mean, not on a realistic level, no. I mean, would I be a little bit more hyped up? You know, of course, but I think that just what they showed by, you know, hanging in this game until the very last second, gave me all the confidence that a win would have given me. You know, if they would have gone out there and got blown out, then, you know, it might be a little bit different tune, but I feel like with the margin that they lost by, how well they played, the numbers they put up, you know, win or lose, the same kind of confidence and reassurance going into the season is there.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bogle, any final words on the Dallas Cowboys falling to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers tonight?
I don't know about falling, but, that confidence is there, man, and I'm excited for the season. And you know, I really hope that, you know, maybe in the NFC Championship game, we get a rematch of tonight.
I mean, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, it's the Cowboys, and the best thing about what you're looking at is just how weak that division is. We're going to get the Eagles on Sunday, so I'm excited to see what Jalen and that group looks like against this Falcons group, and then you have Washington with Fitzpatrick. Like, is he really going to play 17 games? The defensive front is there, and also, like, Daniel Jones in year three, unless you're betting on a Josh Allen-type jump, which I am not. I would say that it's a really easy path to the Cowboys hosting a playoff game and being right there several months from now. They stay healthy. It's just keeping Dak healthy, because he got hit a lot in this game. He passed a lot, over 50 passes.
Well, he does, but it also, you know, I was mortified whenever he would, you know, I didn't think that he would run an option or anything this game and just kind of try and play it safe. But I think that he, you know, wanted to show that he's 100% and ran a couple option plays. But I don't know. I'm still not 100% confident in him running up and down the field. So if we can keep him in the pocket like he did tonight, I think we'll be all right.
All right. There you go. Mr. Bogle, thank you for making the time. I appreciate it. I will talk to you soon, buddy.
Yes, sir. Anytime. All right.
All right, hello, and welcome back to the Chase Thomas Podcast as we roll along this latest episode where I am now joined by Perry Goldstein, a co-worker at Pack-A-Day, a very good Green Bay Packers podcast that you should go subscribe to if you have not already, because the NFL season kicks off this weekend, the Packers being one of the highlights of this weekend, and we're basically on the same team, Perry, because I would like, as an Atlanta Falcons fan, an ATLian, for the Packers to knock off the Saints in week one. That would be a delight. Perry, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here. And yes, I too would like the Packers to knock off the Saints on Sunday.
It would be great. Well, let's talk about this game because it got moved. It was going to be in New Orleans originally. It's really unfortunate and just horrible as to why this game did move, and thoughts, prayers continue to be with the good folks down there in New Orleans in the area. But this game has been moved, and it got moved by all accounts because the Saints did their homework and were like, well, he doesn't fare well in Florida around this time. So, and that person being Aaron Rodgers, what do you make of the Saints pushing this game to Jacksonville from the get-go?
I think it's kind of funny, the research that they did looking at, I heard they looked at flight prices to see like if Packers fans would travel well. Packers fans always travel well, so nice try. I think that regardless, there were very few places that were going to be worse to play as an away team than the Superdome, right? The Superdome's really loud. Saints fans are really involved in the game. It's a really tough place to play. So between, I think, like Arrowhead and probably Seattle, those are like one of the three like hardest places for the Packers to play in history. So anywhere besides those three, I'm kind of happy with the move. I definitely feel for the Saints, like losing a home game, that's tough. That home field advantage for them is very real, but I don't mind that the Packers are playing in Jacksonville.
Okay. Are Packers fans nervous? Is that just you? Does the Pack-A-Day podcast share this sentiment? Where are the heads at going into this game?
I don't think anybody's really that nervous about where they play. I mean, Aaron Rodgers has played everywhere at this point. He has experience at every single field. So I think we're feeling okay.
Are you, like, this is such an interesting situation for Packers fans, I imagine. Like, are you mentally prepared to just, like, go into this year knowing that this is, by all accounts, by just all objective measures, that this is it for Aaron Rodgers in a Green Bay uniform? Are you preparing? Are you changing how you're viewing this season? How does this being it for Rodgers and Davante Adams, too, by all accounts as well, Are you ready for that? Is that going to be in the back of your mind every week? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I think that there was a level of denial last season amongst fans, like not really understanding where Rodgers stood with the organization. And then you kind of got hit, I should say punched in the face by everything that happened this offseason, to the point where I think a lot of fans were kind of on the side of expecting that he wasn't even going to come back for the 2021 season. So now that he is, there's definitely a sentiment of, okay, this is the last dance. This is our last year with Aaron Rodgers, who, you know, he got drafted to the league when I was 9. So my entire life of being a fan of my team has been Aaron Rodgers. And that's kind of a hard transition to kind of, you know, get mentally prepared to shift out of. So I'm glad we kind of have this final season to enjoy him. I'm certainly going to kind of bask in it and not let any moment, take any moment for granted. You know, one of the best to ever do it for my team. That's just something you don't get every day. I think that there's kind of an understanding that the chances of him coming back in 2022 are really, really slim. Now, I don't know if everyone has the same thoughts about Davante. I think there's still a really, really strong hope that Davante re-signs. From what I've heard, everyone inside the building wants him to re-sign. Like, there's not really a sense that they want to let Davante walk, right? But there's certainly like a denial factor there, but not so much with Rodgers.
My dog is also very much pro Davante re-signing.
I appreciate it.
in Green Bay. I have no idea. She never barks. This, I'm guessing the mailman's here. So there you go. This is the fun part of having a home studio. So I apologize for that. Yeah, it just seems like, I don't know, they're tagging together, and it. Well, I guess we'll learn how much Devontae values Aaron Rodgers' perspective, right? Like, if he's out, then it's already just the organization's priority, pretty peeved about everything that's gone on here. But like, if Aaron also talks Devontae out of resigning, and they don't even join up together, because like, by all accounts, you have the option in Vegas to rejoin his college teammate at Fresno with Derek Carr. But yeah, it should be interesting to see how that all unfolds. But one of the cool things is, as sports fans, is we can compartmentalize all of this and push it to the side and like, just forget. Like, I am compartmentalizing that Julio Jones is not on my team anymore, and that is very sad. But guess what? I have Kyle Pitts in my life now, and I'm very excited to experience that, and I'm just going to shield it. I'm going to forget that the Falcons do not have the pass rush to really compete for a Super Bowl this year. No, I'm going in blind. 0-0, Eagles at home. It's great. I'm excited. The secondary, that is the lasting memory I think a lot of NFL fans have of Green Bay with poor King in that game against Tampa Bay. But when you look at what Jameis and this New Orleans Saints team is bringing, Marquez Callaway, no Michael Thomas in this game, Alvin Kamara as a wideout option, how do you like the secondary matchup against the Saints? And do you think the secondary will be improved this season with the new DC?
Yeah. So you ask me a great question. That is my favorite position group to study. I love the DBs. I am really, really excited about this secondary. I think Joe Barry is by all accounts like the offseason signing for the Packers. They did a kind of run it back. They didn't sign any big free agents. Their big free agent was Joe Barry. And really the goal is, can Joe Barry do what Mike Pettine couldn't, which is put together all these incredible pieces that we have, because I feel like there's so much talent on this team and they just couldn't quite put it all together and wrap it up into this nice, neat little bow. So I really want to see if Joe Barry can do that. I think another piece of this, right, is actually the defensive back coach, Jerry Gray, was promoted to being the defensive passing game coordinator. So he actually has a lot more say now across the defense alongside Joe Barry. And that, I think, is going to also be really key, because he was really integral in the development of Jaire Alexander last year. I think, by all accounts, Packers fans have a lot of faith in that this is going to be kind of the first Pro Bowl year for Darnell Savage, safety out of Maryland. And he really showed, I think, in the last, you know, half of last season that he can be that guy. I think Adrian Amos is one of the most underrated safeties in the league as well. So that tandem, I think, is going to wreak havoc. From the perspective of the Saints game this week, Michael Thomas isn't out there. The rest of the Saints, you know, pass catchers are kind of a question mark. So I don't think the secondary necessarily has a big task ahead of them. Who you're game planning for, right, is Alvin Kamara, who can, you know, catch passes out of the backfield. He can do pretty much everything. He can be that one-man show. I think it's actually going to be more about the secondary making sure that they take him down when he gets to that second level, because you know that Alvin Kamara is going to be able to do that. He can turn what's supposed to be a 5-yard slant into a 40-yard gain very, very quickly. So can the secondary tackle, which from me watching has been kind of a problem in the past years for the Packers secondary. So from the Jameis's arm, yes, it's big. He's also, you know, prone to making mistakes as well. I think if the Packers pass rush can get to him and kind of rattle the pocket, you know, they can maybe come up with a turnover or two. And obviously the turnover battle is going to be big. So I'm not super worried about their pass catchers. Really, it's just Alvin Kamara.
Interesting. Yeah, and also we should mention Tre'Quan Smith, who I think is really good and should be good for them. And Chris Hogan, who just made the team. He bounced back and forth between Premier League lacrosse and back to the NFL. So maybe he's somebody to watch in this game as well. Something else that I think is interesting about this Packers team, and people might not know going in, is that no Bakhtiari. Like, the left tackle is out. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Jenkins, right, starting at the left tackle spot?
Yep.
How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that? Multiple rookies starting on this offensive line, it looks like. A college free agent at the left guard spot. Like, I'm very concerned about the offensive line, at least early on in Green Bay. Are you just as concerned, especially with a very good New Orleans Saints front seven?
Yeah, that's going to be a big one, I think, because they've got both, you know, Cam Jordan and Marcus Davenport who are going to be coming off edge. I have so much confidence in Elgton Jenkins moving to left tackle.
Okay.
I think it's more about the domino effect of that move for the next 6 weeks. That's the biggest question mark. Because Elgton Jenkins, I mean, I think this is going to be the year where the league kind of realizes, like, this guy's a stud. Eventually, he's going to have to choose one position to really become elite at. But he has played all five positions at some point since entering the league, which is just insane. So I'm not super worried about Rodgers' blind side. I'm really more like, okay, so there's two rookies starting side by side in the interior. And that's going to be big, obviously, for protecting Rodgers, but also huge in the run game. And getting that run game going is going to be really important in this game. So bright lights, first game, you're protecting Aaron Rodgers. I just hope the moment isn't too big for them. I do trust the Packers coaching staff in that they're going to put out the best five that they can. And I know that Rodgers has spent a lot of time with rookie center Josh Myers this training camp, you know, developing that relationship that you need to have with your center, coaching him up, all those things. He's actually, fun fact, the largest center Rodgers has ever played with. He's like 6'5", 6'6". He's like humongous, which is kind of funny. Luckily, Rodgers is a tall guy, so he can see over him. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm certainly concerned. I think from an outside looking in, if I was, you know, judging this from another team, I'd be like, whoa, that's a lot of change there. But like I said, I kind of trust the coaching staff and the O-line coach, Adam Stanovich, to prep these guys for this game.
Okay. How does the distribution work in the backfield? This is not even just from a fantasy perspective. It's AJ Dillon, obviously, big pick last year. You still got Aaron Jones in the fold. You got a lot of dudes in the backfield, a lot of mouths to feed. How do you think the carry distribution works in week one?
Yeah, I think that it's going to be, you know, Matt LaFleur has really, really been very vocal about how important a running back rotation is for him and for this offense. And I don't know if they, I think that this sharing of carries between Jones and Dillon is going to be really important for just like keeping both of their legs fresh and ready to go. Aaron Jones is, you know, one of the best backs in the league. Obviously he re-signed to come back, but he definitely has like some injury history that you want to protect. And he's so dynamic when he's on the field and he really changes the game. So I'm looking at like a 60-65 Aaron Jones, sort of 40-35 AJ Dillon. I expected, but then again, I kind of go back and I think I expected AJ Dillon to be a little bit more involved last season and he wasn't, but he's presumably going to take all of Jamal Williams snaps and more. So that's kind of the breakdown I'm looking at. I think sneaky to watch, maybe not week one, but kind of later in the season, is Kylan Hill. The Packers just drafted him this year in the 7th round. I do not understand how he fell to the 7th round, but he is the most complete rookie running back I've ever seen, just from a pass pro perspective, from the way that he runs, from pass catching. Like, I think he's actually going to get involved a little bit more than you would expect. So for now, I think it's going to be a fairly even split, maybe a little bit heavier on Aaron Jones, but later in the season, definitely watch out for Kylan Hill.
I'm glad you mentioned Kylan Hill because I watched a lot of him at Mississippi State. Being here in SEC country, that's like one where I circled. I was like, I tell him some friends, I would go with Kylan Hill in later rounds of the fantasy drafts. That dude could do it all. He's a workhorse and was a star on a bad Mississippi State team at the end of the Joe Moorhead era and kind of got lost in the shuffle with a new staff, and that didn't really work out with him and Leach, and it was just not a good fit. So he just fell off the radar. I think that's really just why he fell in the draft, is like he had a really rough last year and a half, but he also did some really awesome stuff getting the flag changed in Mississippi. So yeah. Kylan Hill is just a good dude, and I'm rooting for him. He's someone who's really easy to root for. So when you look at what Jameis is bringing to the table this week, when you look at what this offense should look like, what is your biggest concern for Jameis Winston, not Taysom Hill, being under center, and also not Drew Brees, because this matchup in 2020 was a high-flying, high-scoring affair. Do you expect a similar result? Do you think this is going to be a high-scoring back-and-forth game? Do you think Jameis will show more than what Drew was able to do last year? What do you make of it?
Yeah, week one is always super finicky, right? Like, I feel like everyone's still kind of shaking the rust off, and you never really know what can happen in a week one matchup. I'm not sure I'm expecting, you know, the 37-30 that we saw last season. I definitely think that both of these offenses are going to score points. I just think Jameis at the point in Drew Brees' career that he was last season, like, could not be more opposite. You know, like, Drew Brees was really, like, paper cutting you down the field. He could not sling it anymore. Whereas Jameis, like, that big deep ball is a threat from him. And if you give him a clean pocket, he can get it done. And that's been the Achilles heel of the Packers secondary, just like we saw in the NFC Championship game, right, is giving up that big play. So as long as I think that they can keep that in check, this will be a close game. But Jameis can really, really beat you with his arm. His athletic ability is obviously why he was drafted, you know, first overall. So I think also sneaky is Sean Payton, right? That he is a really creative. I think he was, like I said, left with Drew Brees, who was kind of at the end of his career, was maybe a little bit stifled in what he could do with Drew Brees' arm. Now he has a Jameis Winston with that ability. Like, what's Sean Payton going to pull out of the bag? And also, is he going to end up using Taysom Hill in some capacity? Because I think he just likes teasing the Packers and see what I got from you and what I've used.
Absolutely. Last thing, and we'll wrap up here. So what is your expectation for Sunday? How do you ultimately see it going? Who would you play? If fantasy folks, who would you bet on having the biggest day? And what do you make of this season for the Packers? How does it go, at least early on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to pick my team to win this one. But I think it's going to be closer than I think most fans would want it to be. Like, I can definitely see this being a one-score game, whether that's touchdown or, like, a late field goal situation. I do not count the Saints out. Like I said, I do not count Sean Payton out. Fantasy, I would watch for MVS, Marquez Valdes-Scantling. I think the Saints have Marshawn Lattimore and then a really big question mark at CB2. So I think you're going to have to account for Davante Adams. And then that leaves guys like Marquez Valdes-Scantling open, who is, if you look at PFF and the stats, one of the best deep threats in the league. I know people question his hands, but he looked really, really good in camp. So I think that's kind of a sleeper maybe for this game. But always the usuals, Davante, Aaron Jones, you know, big Robert Tonyan at tight end, who I think is going to have another big year. So, but I'll go MVS for my sleeper fantasy.
I like it. No Tonyan mentioned, which still just blows my mind that this dude was like going like number three among tight ends in my league this week, and just seeing how much of a big hot commodity he is. Is that weird? Like, did you expect this from Tonyan? Like, why is he suddenly just such a critical part of this Green Bay machine?
There's a couple of things with Tonyan. I think his relationship with Rodgers is really tight, which is a really important aspect of the
Packers. I've heard. Shout out to Jay Kumra.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He's got really sticky hands. He catches everything. I was at camp for a week, and so I was at a couple of practices, and I do not think I watched him drop a single ball. So I think that it's just, right, he's a sneaky workhorse. I've heard like his work ethic, and he's there late, studies the playbook, he's in there. So Rodgers really likes the guy, and so he gives him those targets. I also think that Jace Sternberger has disappointed in a lot of ways in being that kind of move pass catching tight end, and Tonyan's taken over that role from him, and there's not really anyone else to fill it, so he's the go-to guy.
There you go. What can we check out from you ahead of this weekend's big matchup against the Saints?
Sure. So this morning, the Packs What She Said podcast, which is my personal podcast, came out with an episode. That's our Saints preview. We're also actually going to have a live show on Tuesday to recap the game, so you can check that out. I'll be recording with Andy Herman and the Pack A Day podcast this week, so that'll come out on Monday. And yeah, just check out Pack A Day and Packs What She Said.
There you go. Keep up the great work. Thank you so much for making the time today. This was a lot of fun. We'll have to check back in again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Thanks for having me on.
All right, hello, and welcome back to the Friday edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am now joined by someone who covers the Cleveland Indians for Bally Sports. It's Al Pulaski. Al, good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey, good, Chase. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, man. What has happened covering the Cleveland Indians this year? How would you summarize this season for the Tribe?
Well, it's been an interesting one because, when the season started, there were a lot of question marks. Pitching was something that was considered to be the backbone of the club, and it was to start the year. The starting pitching was very strong. Shane Bieber in the first month and a half, couple of months, had a good, strong case for defending his Cy Young Award. Then he went on the injured list. Zach Plesac went on the injured list, and then Aaron Civale went on the injured list. So then the Indians' depth was tested. Relief pitch wise, up until August, the bullpen have been very good, very consistent. There's still a couple of guys that are doing fantastic, but you've also got some other issues that happened there, such as Nick Sandlin getting hurt, and he was having a very good rookie campaign. James Karinchak, who was outstanding in the first half, basically had an all-star type first half, has struggled in the second, so he's been sent down. So that's put the bullpen in a bit of a flux. But again, we've seen some good young arms come up and take the spots. Hitting-wise, it's been very inconsistent outside of Jose Ramirez and Franmil Reyes for the most part. And they've been up and down a little bit too, but a lot less. They've been their typical offensive production-type players where Jose Ramirez is hitting like an all-star and an MVP candidate. And Franmil Reyes, when he gets on one of his homer streaks, he is difficult to pitch to. So that's kind of been the story of the season. Guys getting hurt, but some younger guys coming up, taking their place, and for the most part, doing pretty well. The fact this team has been around 500 all season and dealing with the injuries and dealing with some of the youth where guys still, have not reached their peak or come anywhere close to it as players has been impressive. The big positive for the Indians are a couple of the younger guys, Tristan McKenzie and Cal Quantrill in particular, who had to step in for Bieber and Civale and Plesac, and then to a lesser degree, Eli Morgan. He, too, has done a nice job. But Quantrill and McKenzie especially, they have pitched in the second half like front-of-the-rotation starters. They've really taken steps forward. Eli Morgan has done a nice job. He's improved, too. So when you take a look now at the starting pitching staff, you might have your depth chart for next year out to the first 10. All aligned, which is pretty impressive. And when you look at what potentially could be the starting five next year, assuming everybody's healthy, with Bieber, Civale, Plesac, Quantrill, and McKenzie, out of that starting rotation, most of those guys would be ones, twos, or at worst threes in just about everybody else's rotation. And they're all pretty young, and they're all continuing to grow and develop as well. So they're already good, solid pitchers, and they're getting better. So that's been the big positive to come out of this season. And of course the development of Emmanuel Clase too as a closer. He's now one of the top closers in the game, and he's got just some wicked stuff. So pitching development has been a very big positive for the Indians this year. One of the things the Indians will need to do in the offseason is just solidify that lineup. Can they find some guys to fill out the bottom half, because that's the area where they need the most improvement.
Who's responsible for getting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to McKenzie?
Good question. I don't know, but I'll tell you, I would love to have that problem to where, I had it too when I was young. I was really thin, and I just
he's put on exceptionally any thin though. Al, that man is what 6'5"? Like what? He's so I'm right there with him. I'm tall and lanky. Like I have always been that. Like I empathize with him. I know what it's like. However, right. he makes Chris Sale look a little bit more. Look well-rounded, I guess I'll say. Like the Tristan McKenzie is 6'5". What is he? 170? 150?
Yeah, I think he's about 175.
Okay.
You know what, Jay? It's a good problem to have. I mean,
yeah.
For you, for him, and for me, because now as we're older, now it's not quite as easy to keep the weight off as you get older. However, it's good to kind of start from that position, because then when you get older, it's not as much of a challenge, I guess, as some others. So, yeah, you'd like to see him fill out the frame a little bit more, because it probably will help him the long run with his endurance, you know, going through a full season and maybe even getting a little more power behind the pitches. But, as he gets older, he'll be happy to be more on the thin side when he was young.
Absolutely. You talked about the injuries. If, let's just say, in a perfect world, 9 out of the 10 guys you mentioned remain healthy for the majority of the season, do you think they're on par with the White Sox and could have given the White Sox more of a challenge at the top of the AL Central?
I think they definitely would have given them more of a challenge. You know, that being said, the White Sox have had a very good year. They have a very good lineup, one of the strongest in all of baseball. And the White Sox had to deal with injuries too. Next year, though, when you take a look at this staff, you know, the White Sox are dealing with their own injuries right now. And, you know, they, unfortunately for them, it's happening at the wrong time, because you're getting toward the end of the season here and you've got the playoffs coming up. And clearly the White Sox are going to win the Central Division and be in the postseason. But when you look at it next year, I'm looking at the starting five the Indians are going to put out there, and then the depth they're going to have behind that at AAA, which they're going to probably have five guys in the starting rotation at AAA, that any of those five could be on a major league roster and be starting for a major league team. So that tells you how deep this team is going to be with starting pitching. And I don't know if the White Sox are going to be in the same spot because of the guys they have that, you know, do have injury histories, that have gotten hurt again this year, that are getting older. That's what could be a problem for the White Sox next year. But this year, yeah, it's an interesting question. Could they have given them a little bit more of a challenge? I definitely think so. But in the end of the day, with the White Sox have come out on top, with the lineup they have and with the pitching they've gotten, I would say they probably still would have.
Interesting. Do you think Terry Francona is still coaching or still managing this club a year from now, 2 years from now?
I think so. Yeah, okay. I know he really wants to. You know, and that's he's a baseball lifer, and he loves the sport. He loves being a part of it. I honestly think being a manager is good for him and good for his health. He loves it that much, and he cares about it that much. Now, all that being said, you know, we don't know for sure. You know, we hope he can get his health to a situation where he can manage for a full season for the Indians. But that's the plan. That's what he wants to do. I think it will happen. But as with anything in life, there's no guarantees.
Miles Straw is maybe the most fascinating player. Like, Shane Bieber is expected to just be, like, we just, like, it's just part of our baseball watching experience, is that we just know that Shane Bieber is an elite starting pitcher. What is hard to figure out is what's happening with Miles Straw. Is this real? Do you think this is legit? Have you talked to him about this? Like, what do you make of Miles Straw 2021 season? Because it is, like, his season, along with Bradley Zimmer a little bit, and we'll get to Zimmer too, but Straw seems like someone that he has gone from afterthought and just like someone to just fill the role for a year or two to, like, this guy actually might be a piece to hold on to throughout this reload.
Yeah, I think he's very strong defensively. He is one of the best defensive center fielders we've seen in Cleveland, you know, in my lifetime. Rick Manning, my colleague, was fantastic defensively back in the 80s. Kenny Lofton was very good in the 90s. Great
Atlanta Braves legend, Kenny Lofton.
Yeah. So they, you know, they've had some good defensive center fielders. There's been a few other guys that have been here and done a very strong job for maybe a shorter time. Brad Zimmer's a nice center fielder. But Miles Straw just does, I mean, he's the complete package defensively with the way he, you know, his reads are so good. His jumps on balls are so good. He's got a very strong, accurate arm. He's great at going back on balls. He's good at coming in on balls. There's really nothing he doesn't do well defensively in center field, and that's very comforting to have. And I know as the years have gone on, there's been less emphasis placed on defense in baseball than on offense. But it's still important, and you can see it because we've seen it this year. Occasionally we've had guys in center field that probably shouldn't be there, Then you put somebody like Miles Straw there, and you're like, wow, what a difference. On top of that, he's got some very, you know, he's got very good speed. He's just overall very athletic. That helps in all facets of the game. So defensively, plus-plus defender, maybe the best defensive center fielder in baseball right now, maybe. Offensively, he makes good contact. He runs hard. He's great at stealing bases. He's a very good base runner. So, yeah, I think he's definitely a guy that's going to be a part of this thing moving forward. I think the Indians thought he could be when they acquired him. And when you're able to get him for a guy like Phil Maton, who, taking nothing away from Maton, but he was a middle reliever. And, you know, could he ever have blossomed into a closer? Unlikely. Maybe a setup man was his ceiling. So still, you're trading a guy that's got the potential of a good setup man for an everyday major leaguer that has the potential. He's not there yet, but the potential to be an all-star. The thing in Houston was they had a lot of outfielders. They've got some other young outfielders coming up, and they're all pretty good. So Miles Straw got caught in a numbers game down there. They could afford to trade him. But I think in the long run, they probably made a mistake giving up Miles Straw for Phil Maton. That's just my thought. I think Straw is a very good acquisition. And for what you were able to get him for, I mean, man, that was right now, that's looking like an awfully good trade for the Cleveland Indians.
Zimmer, I mean, just high upside pick years ago now. It's been injuries that have kind of kept him from being an everyday player for the Indians. Do you think what's happening over the last month or so is real, and that he has real staying power?
It's a great question. At times I do. We all see the potential. We've all seen his tape measure blast that he's hit. Sometimes when he gets on a roll offensively, you see it. You see that number one draft pick coming out. He's got exceptional speed. He too always plays hard, always hustles. Defensively, very good. He's right there with Miles Straw. I love when he's in center and Bradley Zimmer's in right, because defensively, they've got 75% of the outfield covered by two guys that are very good at playing the outfield and getting reads, and they both have very good arms. So, you know, defensively, Bradley Zimmer is a plus. Offensively, at times he's a plus, and other times he goes into slumps, and you know, sometimes he still swings at pitches out of the zone that he shouldn't swing at, but he'll take pitches that are strikes. And, you know, granted, it's because he's looking for something else, but he's still a guy that you know, pitchers can pitch to. Can he take that next step? Can he be consistent throughout a 162-game season? The jury's still out. I think he can be. He definitely has the tools to be. He's finally healthy. That was the thing that, you know, made his development tough the last 3 years or so. He just always seemed to be injured, but you know, he's worked hard coming back, and here he is. You really pull for a guy like that. You hope he can do it. The Indians, because he's been injured so much, and part of it was when he was on a minor league roster, so his service time didn't accumulate. He won't be a free agent until 2025, so you still control him for a few more years, and he's in his late 20s. That's unusual to have a guy that's a talent like Bradley Zimmer is, and to still have control of him into his 30s contractually. So I think he can be, but yeah, to be fair and to be honest, the jury is still out to see if he can reach that.
The best player nobody is talking about for Cleveland right now is who?
Boy, that's a good question. I think that changes by the week. You know, when you take a look at it, and sometimes you'll see something there. I think people in Cleveland are talking about Tristan McKenzie and Cal Quantrill.
Okay.
But I think just now people, and still not yet nationally, people realize how well those two have pitched. And it's been against some really good lineups. I mean, Quantrill's faced some tough lineups, and he's gotten through it. Even on days he doesn't have his best stuff, he's still leaving in the fifth or sixth inning, and he's only given up a couple, three runs on his worst days, you know, since July 1st. That tells you how far he has developed, because on his best days, he's going seven innings and he's maybe allowing one run. Tristan McKenzie, his last four starts, he has a whip below 0.5. I believe it's 0.34. Think about that. Over four games at the major league level, guys just aren't getting hits off of him. They are. So people, I think, look at them and say, yeah, you know what, they're really rounding into shape in the second half of the season. But then when you look closer at them and their numbers, Quantrill and McKenzie, And you see it just how dominating they have been in the month of August and now into September. I mean, these guys are pitching like Cy Young Award winners. That being said, they're not going to win the Cy Young. They haven't done it over a whole season. I understand that. But you go from late July until now, you can compare their numbers with any other Cy Young Award candidate, and Quantrill and McKenzie's numbers are right there. So I think both of them are two guys that nobody nationally has really understood just how good they've been playing.
Interesting. When you look at the rest, like, this was something that I was curious about, because they're doing a reload. A lot of the AL Central is just kind of a weird mess at the moment. Like, the Royals are in a very long, they're in a very long rebuild. Then you have the Twins. I don't know how their offseason's going to go. We were all curious about how they would operate at the trade deadline. The White Sox look like they have real staying power at the top of this division for a little bit, with just the amount of young talent they have there. And then you think about where the Indians were. They're just awesome run with those guys, with Kluber and everybody else, that, like, they don't really seem like a team that's, like, going to do a full-on rebuild, that they're doing a retool. Were you surprised they weren't even just a little bit more active? And do you think that they are going to be a little bit more active in the winter to catch up to the White Sox? Or do you think they're going to go the other way, where it's like, we're going to part with Ramirez, we're going to sell high on Miles Straw? Like, what direction do you think they're going to go in?
No, I think they're going to go in the direction of, hey, in 2022, let's go out and win this division.
Yeah.
That's what's been special about this organization and this front office, you know, with Chris Antonetti and Mike Chernoff and, you know, Mark Shapiro before him, along with Ross Atkins, who was running the farm system. I mean, these guys have all been so good, so astute at recognizing talent, developing talent, especially on the pitching side. I don't think there's an organization in baseball that does a better job at developing pitching than the Cleveland Indians. So what they've been able to do, and it's not easy, but continue to compete while you are rebuilding. So this year basically is a one-year rebuild, but they did it while they were still able to compete. They were 10 games over 500 in June, and then injuries caught up to them, and they are where they are now, which is a 500 team. But when you take a look at the way they were able to infuse young, talented players into the organization over the years at different points and trade guys at the right time, the other organization that has done that over the years, the Oakland A's, and now the Tampa Bay Rays, they're the same way. Their payrolls aren't super huge, but they are playing better than a lot of teams that have higher payrolls.
Well, hold on. The Rays have devil magic. It was in the name. They have devil magic. The only explanation for Brandon Lau hitting 40 home runs this season is devil magic, and I can't move past it. I can't move past the Brandon Lau home run experience. I can't do it.
Yeah, he probably will not hit as many home runs this next year and the year after as he has this year. Correct. They've had some things go their way. There's no question about that. And you have to a degree. You've got to have some luck. You've got to stay healthy. But to find the young players, you know, and to have the talent that they do, and to, you know, again, to know when to get off of guys. If you look at some of the guys that they have moved on from, at the moment it happened, there were, oh, I can't believe that you're not re-signing Cody Allen. I can't believe you're not re-signing Andrew Miller, who were fantastic when they were here. 2016, without those two guys, you don't make it to Game 7 of the World Series. Same thing with Kluber and Clevinger and Bauer and Carrasco. And now Francisco Lindor, although if Francisco would have been open to staying here and taking less money, the Indians would have signed him. There's no question. But you look at the deals that they made with these guys. They've made some fantastic deals. They've gotten guys back that are younger and now the cornerstones of this franchise. Just, you know, some of the highlights. Bauer, you get Franmil Reyes and then some other guys. Mike Clevinger. Cal Quantrill was in the Mike Clevinger deal along with five other players, including Gabriel Arias, who's one of the top middle infield prospects, I think, in all of baseball. You might see him on the major league roster next year. For Lindor, they got Rosario. There's always somebody there that has come in and been very good. So they've been very good at making trades. They've been very good at knowing when it's time to move on and not get emotionally attached to some guys, and maybe do something like the Detroit Tigers did and sign Miguel Cabrera to that long-term deal for all that money, which has done nothing but hold them back since they signed him to that latest deal. The Tigers are in a perpetual rebuild, it seems. Now, this year they seem like they've turned the corner a little bit, but they're still not where the Indians are. They still don't have the type of talent the Indians do. So being able to do that and doing it quickly and constantly infusing that. So even when you're competitive, if you've got a guy who is on the downside, if you've got a guy that you know is going to require a lot of money to stay here and they're probably not going to resign, instead of letting happen what happened back in the late 90s and early 2000s, where you watched Manny Ramirez walk for nothing and Jim Thome walk away for nothing, and before that, Albert Bell walk away for nothing. They said, these guys have a lot of value. We've got to be able to get something in return for that. And that's why the Indians haven't had to go through their 2 or 3 year rebuild, which for some organizations turns into a 5 year rebuild, like the Tigers, or maybe longer. And you mentioned Kansas City. That's a great point. They've got some nice young players. They still have Whit Merrifield, who I think is one of the most solid all-around players in the game.
Been on the trade block forever.
Yeah. But do these guys have enough? Does Kansas City have enough next year to compete in the division? I don't think so. Do the Tigers? I don't think so. The Twins, we know, will not.
They're a wild card. The Twins are a wild card. I don't know. Like, so many people just have them still winning the division this year. A lot of it depends on what they do with Polanco, how they address the starting pitching. I don't know. The Twins, I'm not going to strike through them.
Okay, but here's the thing with them. They still have aging players and expensive contracts. Now, Josh Donaldson's had a very good year.
Mm-hmm.
But how much longer is he going to produce? And look what you're paying him. I mean, the Indians don't have any contracts like that. So they're going to be able in this offseason to go out and sign a guy or two that are going to be quality free agents that you can insert into this lineup and be, maybe be difference makers.
Absolutely. I agree. They're just hanging around. They're going to be interesting to monitor this winter. Your favorite moment this season has been what?
I'll give you two of them. One is more of a general this season. You know, watching some of these young guys develop, especially the pitchers, you know, Quantrill and McKenzie, I love seeing guys develop, especially young pitchers really blossom, and you're seeing that with Quantrill and McKenzie and Emmanuel Clase. Watching those guys get to where they are, that has been a lot of fun.
What if I were to offer you a Sean Newcomb for a Tristan McKenzie?
No.
No?
Okay. Not now. No. Now, if
how about a Bryce Wilson?
April or May.
How about a Kyle Wright? How about every Brave starting pitcher that has been developed through our pipeline that's not working out as right now? That what about any of those? How about that?
Yeah, if you gave me like three of them, I might think about it because you figure you're going to have one that you can develop. But you know, I do like Yanoa. He's a nice looking.
It would be great if he could stay healthy.
But I don't think the Braves are trading him.
I guess not. He was in an insane story at the beginning of the year, but Morton's been the huge surprise in Atlanta. Like, that dude is just now he's locked in, got an extension. Like, I thought he was going to retire for this year, and now he's going to be around. But he is the leader for this staff. And I miss Soroka, though. I miss Soroka being in my life. That's been hard. Mike Soroka just being gone, and now it's like, are we sure that Mike Soroka can finish a full baseball season? That's where we're at this point. Just with the injury proneness, it stinks because he is just so supremely talented. It would just be a Cy Young candidate year after year. It's very annoying. I'm not a fan, Al.
Yeah, it's unfortunate when guys get hurt, especially talented guys. But it's a part of sports.
Yeah. Absolutely. Last thing here, and we'll wrap up. Minor league. We have September call-ups. It's September 9th. Is there anyone on the precipice of joining the big leagues on Cleveland's roster or has already that you're most excited about watching and fans should be attuned to?
I don't think anybody anymore this year that you haven't already seen.
Mm-hmm.
For next year, I mentioned, you know, Arias. He is an exciting young player. Oscar Gonzalez has had a fantastic minor league campaign. He had 13 home runs at Akron, got promoted to AAA Columbus, hit 13 home runs there, all while hitting well above 300 combined. So you've got a couple of very exciting young players. And Brian Rocio, that's in AA Akron, he's 20 years old, and he's got power, and he's a good-looking shortstop. He's going to play AAA next year at 21. He's a guy that probably has the ability as soon as next year to play at the major league level. So I don't think any more this year, Chase, but I think there's definitely young guys that are very exciting that you're going to see as early as next year. Some guys that put themselves on the radio or on the radar. Two other guys too, that they picked up, the two pitchers, double A pitchers, Pilkington, a left-hander, they picked up at the trade deadline for Cesar Hernandez, and Battenfield, the guy they picked up from Tampa Bay for the Jordan Luplo deal. Those guys have just dominated in double-A. Next year, they're most likely going to be in big league camp. I don't think they're going to make the big league team. The Indians have a lot of pitchers in front of them, but there are a couple other guys that are probably going to start the year in the triple-A rotation, and they are exceptional talents. You know, very similar, some of these guys you mentioned for the Braves, some of these young pitchers coming up, and all those guys you mentioned, talented, you know, there's injuries here. Some guys don't develop at the same level once you hit the majors. It's a hard place to develop because the hitters are so good. But those pitchers that I just mentioned, those young kids, they're just like what Atlanta has, because Atlanta has a history of always developing great pitching, too. I would say, you know, what the Indians are doing now with their young pitchers, very similar to what the Braves had and have coming up.
Okay. But who can forget 1995? Who can forget? What a run that was.
Well, the strike zone was a lot bigger for Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux than it was for the Indians guys, though.
That's enough. That's enough. I won't hear to it. I won't accept it. I was 4 years old. I couldn't make it out. I can't confirm or deny what the strike zone was like. I just can tell you that my parents' basement, the Man Cave, has all kinds of great 1995 Atlanta Braves victory sports memorabilia. Leave the memories alone.
That was a great series. It really was, even though it only went six games. It should have gone seven. Here's the problem. You know, back then, the team with the best record had home field advantage. They'd switch it between American League and National League every year. So even though the Indians had won 100 games in a 144-game season and had won more games than the Braves, the Braves still got home field advantage.
Are we making excuses 26 years later, Al? Is that what's happening here? The best teams make do. The Braves would have won it without home field advantage. People know. Everyone knows.
It was too closely matched, and something like home field advantage can make the difference. If the Indians had home field advantage, if they had game 6 and 7 in Cleveland, I think that the Indians would have won that series.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, we got one World Series after 14 straight division titles. So I think give us one during that insane run.
You know what? Now, see, that's like the Cubs argument, Chase. It's like, oh, you know, we haven't won in so many years. Well, we haven't either. It's been since 1948. Doggone it, we deserve one.
You have a fair point. But you have the Cavs. Cavs want a title. You got LeBron back for a little bit.
Cavs in 2016. Yep.
Yeah, and the
way things are looking with the Cavaliers, that might be the only title they ever win. But yes, they got one in 2016.
So hey, I don't know. The Browns look really good this year. Browns are an appetizing AFC bet. If the Chiefs stumble a little bit.
On offense.
The Browns are right there, man. I don't know. Things are looking up. Not the Blue Jackets, really.
No, that's been the heartbreak. The Indians have always been right on the doorstep. Mm-hmm. The Browns, they were on the doorstep back in the 80s, and John Elway stopped them every single time. But, you know, they've been there. They've had chances. The Cavaliers, you know, they only won one finals, and they were there multiple times when LeBron James was here and Kyrie Irving, and you know, it was him and those two and Kevin Love, and they were the big three, and then he had some good guys around them too. But they only, just like the Braves, even though that was, you know, a very strong team when the years LeBron was here, they were, along with Golden State, those two were the best teams in basketball. The problem was Golden State. If Golden State hadn't existed, Cavaliers might have three or four titles instead of just one. Same thing with the Browns back in the 80s. If the Broncos hadn't, if John Elway wasn't, if he'd have stayed with the Colts, or if he was, maybe the Browns would have a couple of Super Bowls. So that's what's been hard. And then you look at the Indians and you think, man, 95, they had the best team in baseball and they just didn't win it. 97, they were the team of destiny, and destiny was stolen from them in game 7 against the Marlins. And think about that too. The Marlins. I mean, that's an organization, a city that they don't even really care about baseball. I mean, we care about baseball in Cleveland a whole lot. they get a world championship, and then they get another one in 03, and we don't.
Also, can we mention that I'm annoyed that they – we were counting last year as a playoff loss for them, right?
Yeah.
So the streak's over, because that was, like, my favorite dumb sports thing of, like you said, no one cares in Miami, and they're out here winning World Series whenever they make the playoffs. Like, that's just an insane run, and I just very much enjoyed that. I'm not going to lie. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, no kidding. And I mean, 07. I mean, I don't know if you remember that, but the Indians made it to Game 7 of the ALCS with the Boston Red Sox, and they were up 3-1 in that series, and they should have won that series. That would have put them in the World Series against the Colorado Rockies, who had that long winning streak in September to get to the postseason. They had to rest for so long and wait to play. It was almost, I don't know, like 10 or 12 days. The Red Sox just ran right through them in the World Series. The Indians would have won that World Series in 07 easily, but they lost the ALCS. And then, of course, 2016, we all know about the Cubs.
But see, the 2016 series, you joke about it, but like that's my favorite World Series in my adult life. Like, that has been my favorite to this point. Like, I remember just being up until 1:30 in the morning watching, and the Raji Davis home run, and just how that series went and how tight it was and how evenly matched it was, and just the impact of the Cubs winning a World Series. Like, that was must-see television. Y'all were the huge villains that series, because nobody wanted Cleveland to, no one cared about the 1940 whatever stuff.
We kept hearing about how the poor Cubs fans, and I wanted to say, wait a minute. If we're talking Chicago, and I was on a PBS show about 5 years ago during this time with Rick Tellender from Chicago, and it's the same thing, and I get it. That was the argument, like, oh, you know, hey, poor Cubs fans, just, hey, Cleveland, just take a knee, give it to us. Wait a minute, okay? Michael Jordan, all right? The 85 Bears, the Blackhawks, who else did you have to? Oh, yeah, the White Sox. They'd want a few. Don't tell me Chicago doesn't know what it's like.
Are we moving past the Bulls, the best dynasty in NBA history? Yeah.
The Cavs. This was supposed to be our year, period.
Oh, man. You're not going to get any sympathy out of me for the Factory of Sadness, being from Atlanta. Like, you're not going to get that. I've seen one in my lifetime, and I was 4 years old.
But you saw one.
I did see one. I mean, I guess we go back and forth because there are Atlanta fans that count Atlanta United as a title from a couple years ago.
Okay.
And that's tough because Atlanta United is fun to watch, but MLS.
Soccer games.
Say that again?
And our indoor soccer team won. The Cleveland Crunch won in 1999. And I count that. So that counts.
Do you count that? That's not even MLS.
I count. You know what? I really liked indoor. I still like indoor soccer. I think it's a fantastic sport.
It's a lot more brutal than you would expect. My dad played indoor soccer growing up. He played soccer in college, and he played indoor when he got older. And just seeing my dad just slam dudes into the wall, it's not glass. It's like, it looks like glass, but I don't know what to describe. What is the top material?
The wall gives a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just like it's bizarre. It's like watching soccer and hockey mixed together, and it's, I don't know. It's pretty intense.
It is intense, no question.
Al, I did not think we would wrap up today's podcast talking about indoor soccer and the Cleveland Crunch, but that is how the cookie crumbles sometimes. I like it. How can we check out your work across Valley Sports this week?
Well, very good. Yeah, we do a pre- and post-game show on Valley Sports Great Lakes, so if you have the RSN package, you can see it there. And then I'll be doing Cleveland State basketball this winter, and you can catch that. We will be streamed somewhere. So you'll be able to hear that anywhere in the world. And
you kept your coach, right?
I also do some sports anchoring too. What's that?
You kept your coach, right? The one who was long.
Yeah, Dennis Gates. Yeah.
Yes, that's his name. Exactly. Yeah, he was a hot commodity.
Yeah.
Still a hot commodity.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. He is a wonderful guy. Fantastic head coach. He has got the program in a great spot. As does Scott Garrett, the athletic director. They have done such a great job with Cleveland State, and they should be the favorites to win the Horizon League again. And they got some tough teams. We're opening at Brigham Young. We've got to go to we've got a game at Oklahoma State. We're going to play at Duke this year, and we've got Ohio University, who also went to the tournament, coming to our building, the Wolstein Center, to open up the season. So it's going to be an interesting basketball season for Cleveland State. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
I don't think it's going to be as fun as my Tennessee Volunteers. Just five-star after five-star after five-star in this starting lineup for Rick Barnes. Just putting on a recruiting clinic to replace Keon Johnson and Jaden Springer. I don't know. Do we play all this year? I don't think so. I don't think.
Maybe so. You know, maybe sometime. We were down in Tennessee a year or two ago.
Mm.
We played. Oh my goodness! Now it escapes me. This is what happens as you start getting older. You start forgetting things, so they all blend together. But yeah.
Well, I just turned 30. I hope that's not the case. I hope that's not. I hope that's not happening right now. Also, just being in grad school, I think I'm required to remember stuff and write papers on them. I think is part of the process.
Yeah, good to get that degree.
Yeah.
Well, very good. I enjoyed the conversation.
Al, thank you so much. Stay safe out there. We'll have to check back in again soon.
Sounds good, Steve.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.